This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa idh qala Ibrahim rabbi arini kayfa tuhyil mauta qala awalam tu'min qala bala walakin liyatma'inna qalbi. قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take 4 of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by a affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. U.S. households are confronting a deepening affordability squeeze, and that is reshaping how they shop, dine, and finance daily life, creating new challenges for U.S. leadership, and is fueling growing discontent with U.S. President Donald Trump's job performance. In fact, a recent NBC News poll found 66% of voters feel Trump has fallen short of expectations around inflation and the cost of living. Younger Americans continue falling further behind as well. Just last month, a housing study showed that people born in the 1990s are projected to retire with home ownership rates 9.6 percentage points lower than the previous generation. Now, according to a Poverty Tracker annual report also from Columbia University, over half of U.S. residents in major cities, including a quarter of all children, either live in poverty or are low income. The price of major food staples like eggs, sugar, and meat, especially beef, increased in 2025 and are expected to continue rising. Here's a package.
U.S. President Donald Trump held a campaign-style rally at the Mount Airy Casino Resort, aiming to convince Americans that his economic policies are successfully tackling a persistent cost of living crisis. His message of a rapidly improving economy, however, was directly challenged by recent government data and the experiences of every U.S. citizen. Facing political pressure with midterm elections approaching, Trump asserted that prices were dropping, credited his administration's policies, shifting blame to his predecessor, President Joe Biden.
And I have no higher priority than making America affordable again. That's what we're going to do. And again, they caused the high prices and we're bringing them down. It's a simple message.
Trump's optimistic assessment clashes with key economic indicators. Government figures show that while the price has fallen from recent peaks, broader inflation remains stubborn. The annual consumer price index sat at 3% in September, higher than at any point during Trump's first term and above the rate in Biden's final full month in office. Essential grocery items continue to see sharp increases. Beef prices are up nearly 15%, bananas 7%, and coffee more than 20% compared to a year ago. Other metrics show job growth has slowed and unemployment has risen to a four-year high during Trump's current term. The rally revealed a notable adjustment in the Trump rhetoric after facing criticism for recently dismissing affordability concerns as a Democratic hoax. Trump appeared to recalibrate.
And I can't say affordability hoax because I agree the prices were too high, so I can't call it a hoax because they'll misconstrue that. But they use the word affordability, and that's their only word. They say affordability, and everyone says, oh, that must mean Trump has high prices.
Trump's approval rating on his handling of the cost of living remains low at 31%, indicating the steep challenge he faces in convincing the public of an economic turnaround. U.S. citizens' daily experiences at grocery stores and gas stations are forming a powerful counter-narrative to the optimism projected from the podium. The Pennsylvania event is the first in a series planned by Trump and his cabinet ahead of the 2026 midterms. The location was strategically chosen. Pennsylvania's 8th district is a competitive area seen as critical for Republicans to hold control of Congress. For voters facing higher prices, the gap between Trump promises and their reality is widening. Millions of Americans are deeply frustrated with their affordability and their economy, threatening the very foundations of Trump's political support.
And now your guests for the program. Sir John Edmonds, economist, academic, and author, joining us out of Massachusetts. And Marcia Baker, economic expert, joining us out of Washington, D.C. Hello, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll do the gentlemanly thing here, and Ms. Baker, we'll start with you. Your initial thoughts, please, on the financial situation that most Americans seem to find themselves in these days.
Well, the United States is in a phase of economic decline, so there's no question about the data coming out that households are facing higher prices in everything, from housing to food and so forth. But it's also true that if you have an economy where credit that is available only going into speculation, to data centers, to non-basic areas, it's not going into steel, independent farming, new health care. If these basic sectors are declining while your debts and speculation are increasing as a nation, we have $100 trillion in total government, private, and debts of all kinds, plus a toxic cloud above that of derivative and crazy speculation plus crypto. This is impossible now to hide or to deny by households. This week, just one example, Washington, the Trump administration had to announce they'll make available a bridge grant of $12 billion in aid by the end of February to farmers and ranchers in the country because their livelihoods are not stable and they're facing ruin. So definitely this is an economic decline picture, not a temporary cycle or a dip or something that's going to be fixed by today's new Federal Reserve interest rate changes.
Thank you, ma'am, for your initial take there. Professor John Edmonds, welcome to the program, sir. Mr. Edmonds, your initial take, please, on today's economic pressure on American families. Why is it just up until it seems like about 20 years ago, possibly the last time we saw a decent percentage of American families have the opportunity to sit down, plan, save, and invest for in their future was around 2005 or six. It seems it's really like we barely hear that from families have that luxury these days.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate this opportunity, and I certainly agree with the assessment of the other presenter. I'm the guy in my house who goes to the grocery store. I don't think that the president goes to very many grocery stores. I go routinely once or twice a month. And I not only buy food, but I walk around and I look at what other people are buying and I look at what they're picking up and putting back on the shelf. And I can tell you that a lot of things that I routinely buy are much more expensive. I buy them anyway because I'm above all that. But I'm very aware of the effect of the tariffs. For example, I I'm very, very much a fan of coffee, especially premium coffee. And premium coffee is a lot more expensive than it was, even though they just rolled back the tariff on coffee from Brazil. Besides that, I think we should mention the price of eggs, which a lot of people were talking about. But one reason why eggs have come down more than some other foodstuffs recently is because the farmers who grew a bunch of corn and soybeans are not able to sell it to China because China has decided that if you want to have a trade war, let's hit the group that voted in highest numbers for this government. And so they're sitting there with corn. Now you can either let it rot or you can feed it to pigs and chicken and get pork and eggs and chicken out of it. Or you can grind it up and make ethanol out of it. And ethanol is intrinsically uneconomical, especially now that we have net exports of crude oil and refined products. So I would say the cost of living is definitely going up, and a lot of people are feeling it, regardless of what anybody might say. And the other question I would bring up is, how much trust should we have in the data? I lived in third world countries where they would routinely adjust the numbers, or as we say in American slang, fudge them. But in the U.S., after the Bureau of Labor Statistics head was fired, the next person miraculously reported better numbers. I'm really astonished to tell you that, but it's not really a joke. It's if I got that job, I wouldn't put out any bad numbers either, but I wouldn't put out any true numbers.
Thank you, Mr. Edmonds. Ms. Baker, Democrats, meanwhile, they're making this issue of affordability central to many of their campaigns. Now, while Trump has called it, these affordability concerns, a Democratic hoax. But my question to you, how much of this mismanagement can be attributed to his administration? How much of it is just part of the trajectory that's been moving, regardless of which party's been in the Oval Office over the past few decades?
I'm sorry to say it's your suggestion that it's both parties plus independents for many decades that allowed the increased deregulation of the economy, including in North America with Canada, Mexico, and allowed transnationals to come in the case of food, which John was just mentioning shopping for, allowing the United States is 70% dependent for fresh tomatoes for Mexico that come in trucks. Mexico, the home of corn, is 50% dependent on the U.S. sending corn to Mexico. Who gains? The Wall Street complex of transnationals, Cargill, JBS, the meat packer. We have a terminal condition of our United States economy, and it's been Democrats, Republicans all going for it. So now is the point where we have to make a change.
I'll put that same question to you, Mr. Edmonds. How guilty do you see the Trump administration? A recent poll shows 2/3 of Americans feel he is completely disconnected. His policies only favor billionaires and the wealthy. And if he has nothing, if he has little, less to do with this current crisis than many want to lead on to believing. Nevertheless, it seems fair to say that his tariff wars are at least to blame to an extent. But your overall assessment of his administration's really the hand they played in this current cost of living crisis in America.
The tariff wars are a big part of the current situation, but I would reaffirm what Marcia just said, that it's been many years since younger people are looking forward to having less prosperity than their parents had, and you can't do that very long and remain popular. But I would also reaffirm what Marcia said about favoring Wall Street tycoons, and particularly in the first Trump government, there was an enormous tax law change that greatly favored corporations and the wealthy. And then we have another one in this previously passed so-called Big Bill, Beautiful Bill, and the consequence is that you make more money speculating on stocks, particularly the big seven, the Magnificent Seven, as they're called, and you make more on that than you would on what I call real business, that is going out and making physical products. And with regard to trade in agricultural goods, yes, certainly. We have brought in tomatoes from Mexico for many, many years. And we also brought in labor from Mexico going back to the 1940s to pick the tomatoes. And then we found that many of them were staying. And then now this is a wave of anti-immigrant sentiment. So the people that used to do the physical labor in construction and the physical labor in agriculture are being sent back to where they came from, if it really is that they were not born here. But many of the people who've been picked up and deported were U.S. citizens, but that's not the subject of this particular show. But what we have is a labor shortage in several skill categories, particularly the high skill categories. The people that take my classes, for example, half of them are foreigners, and if they don't leave, then they face a deportation notice pretty quickly. But then if you look at who's actually doing the heavy physical labor, who cut your grass? Who laundered your shirts? Who was working the back room of the restaurant where you went and ate with your friends? Those people are being run out of the country. And near where I live, I'm hiring people to cut my lawn who are teenagers from the neighborhood, but they're all just leaving very promptly and going to college, so they're not available anymore. So that's turning into a pattern, which is stratification of the population, and stratification not just a rich versus poor, but super rich, not so very rich, and then the poor. We have to divide them into lower middle class and really, really poor. And we're going to see them really poor after the 1st of January when their health care premiums go up. A lot of people are going to have to drop health care, and those who retain it won't have money for anything else.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Ms. Baker, nearly $1 trillion, you very well know, in military spending each and every year. And ironically, the student loan debt that's accrued over all the years has reached an unprecedented $1.81 trillion today, according to the Education Data Initiative. Can some of the problems in the U.S. financially be better resolved if there's a logical and calculated reshuffling of priorities by policymakers?
Yes, that is part of it. In other words, we should reset policy based on principle, which we can work out. We have precedents in the 1930s in the United States when the new president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, came in. A bill was passed named after two senators called Glass and Senator Stegall, and they reorganized banking. So you had banking of credit you need for operations and economic activity, and you did not back up finance for speculation. You put a wall in between. There is a move now, rightly, to reintroduce that in the United States. And it has, in different forms, it has a universal principle. China observes it. Other nations observe it. So that's the kind of setting aside unworthy, unpayable debt. I call unworthy debt a lot of the trillions in speculative counter obligations on derivatives connected to Wall Street, City of London, the international billionaire class. It's going to otherwise explode. I can't tell you which day, but it's unsustainable. Then we can organize credit for priority projects, rebuild rail, and collect majority who's building in Africa and other places, ports, dams, electricity, that can get us out of the otherwise inevitable crisis you're seeing worsen here in the U.S.
I can put that same question to you, Mr. Edmonds. Today, you very well know unemployment, you may not know, but unemployment today in America has risen to its highest level in 4 years, and consumer prices, this you know, remain high and seem to be getting worse by the day. Housing costs are a nightmare, whether you're a buying or a renter or paying a mortgage. I mean, higher education, you very well know, it's very pricey, while entry-level jobs for a graduate pay the equivalence of a fast food chain. What needs to change by policymakers to address this current crisis?
Well, let's start with the student loans. When I got my various degrees, I graduated owing $11,000 in debt, and my salary was much higher than that already. But then besides that, the interest rate on those debts were low, inflation was high, and the interest was tax deductible. So by the time I finished paying off those loans, they were less than my monthly electric bill, and I honestly didn't even notice it. Whereas this generation, if they got half the degrees that I have, they would have a debt burden that they can't pay. Now, another thing that has really happened, which is quite profound and definitely damaging the generation of people that are now turning 18 or 25, is the compensation that people get is so much lower. When I was an undergrad, I got a job washing dishes for a while for $2.50 an hour. And then a very short while later, I got a job programming computers at $10 an hour. In other words, the ratio of 4 to 1, what I got for white collar work versus blue collar work. That ratio is now nowhere near as large. I mean, right now, people around where I am right now are making $17 an hour working in a fast food restaurant. And if they're running the cash register, they're making $19 an hour. And if they're sitting in the office doing the books, they're probably also making $19 or maybe $21 an hour. And then where's the 4 to 1 ratio? It's gone. So getting a college degree, I cannot look an 18-year-old in the eye right now and say you should bend every effort and even incur some debt to get a college degree. It wouldn't be a rewarding investment. And that's devastating. And when you combine that with deporting the people that do get a college degree, you end up with a population that is underqualified for the jobs that are available. So unemployment comes from that. That is to say, there's a lot of people out there who'd like to have a job or they'd like to have a better job than what they have now, but they can't qualify. They don't have the skill levels, and that's chronic. It's throughout the country, and it seems to just be a fact of life, and you can complain about it, but you can't seem to make it any better.
And I was going to ask a different question, Ms. Baker, but since Mr. Edmonds referred to deporting and immigrants a few times, I'll put this question to you if I could. Politicians, especially Donald Trump, he seized on the opportunity time and again to evade any responsibility for the current economic affairs of the country. And he's pitting his base against immigrants, saying that they're taking your jobs, putting strain on medical and educational infrastructure. Let's build a wall to keep them out, or let's just launch a campaign to round them up and kick them out. Is this the answer, ma'am? All the billions to Ukraine and Israel to fund an unwinnable war or fund a genocide close by? These don't get spoken about, but immigrants somehow are the demons in America today.
Well, this is both ideology and a kind of low-level reflex reaction that's no good, doesn't work, is cruel and mean. And as John has already said, if you have a difficult situation, then you load on tariffs, then you blame migration because Wall Street has not allowed economic development in Central America, in South America. So people are dislocated, looking for where they can have better lives. If you follow that path, it's hopeless, and it's also very dangerous now, being on the verge of having this stupid policy cause an attack on Venezuela here in our own hemisphere. That's crazy. Instead, if you have the development approach, that's the basis for peace and for hope in the future. And so mutually looking at development in ports, in railroads in North America, building the Alaska to lower 48 down to through Central America to South America railroad that was never properly built. That means jobs. It means a spirit of optimism. It means high skills. And when people's homelands are being developed, whether it's in Haiti or Peru or Honduras, you want to stay home and be part of the excitement. Instead, we've had this anti-development policy for over half a century or more, and inevitably that creates dislocated people. So that's the fight.
And Mr. Edmonds, I'm going to put the final thoughts with you, sir, if I could. Many Americans, I read this article just before the show by the Economic Times. It says, many Americans feel trapped in a cycle where income barely covers living costs and every paycheck is a race against time. The strain affects mental health, family stability, and productivity, creating ripple effects across communities. Now, 68% of Americans are walking a financial tightrope, and some studies suggest 7 out of 10 Americans are living paycheck to paycheck, and this includes families from not just low income levels, but all income levels, which is quite remarkable. Why is a country, sir, this rich, have so many families this broke?
The paycheck to paycheck argument is certainly true. I would push the ratio even higher than that. A great many people are not really able to afford the life that they think they should have. And one thing that they can't do, they can't relocate to get another job. They can get the job, perhaps, but the job may be in another city. And there's two things that restrict their mobility. One is housing. If they have a housing situation that they can afford and they move out of that, and they move into one that they can't afford, either because of mortgage rates or because of higher rents in the places where the jobs are. But also, they can't be sure of getting health care in the new place where they would be going, and then the problem might be pre-existing conditions. So if they get health care, it might not cover some of the things that they need to have covered, and that's the big issue for this week's debate in Congress. And I'm not really hearing much debate, except that each side is coming out with a plan that the other side will reject. So I don't know where we get with that, but it's not going to be improvement. So I'm thinking that the unemployment situation will remain bad, and also that the healthcare situation will get worse. And there doesn't seem to be any political will to fix either one of them. Mm. On the contrary, the thing to do is pump more into speculation and just keep on paying more and more for the same probably overpriced stocks. I'm not going to predict a decline or a crash. I'm just going to say that if you consistently pay more than 20 times earnings for a stock in an environment where you have 3% or 4 or 5% inflation, that's not really going to give you much rate of return. But that's what everybody's doing.
And time has gotten the better of us. I want to thank you both for joining us in the program, and stay blessed to the both of you. John Edmonds joining us from Boston, Massachusetts, and Marcy Baker joining us from Washington, D.C. And this brings us to the end of your Spotlight program. Thank you for joining us, and goodbye for now.
Seven, there is pressure.
Come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only King.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Thank you for joining us again. You're listening to IRIB English Radio, and you're listening to The Bookshelf. We have an awesome book for you today, The Seven Story Mountain by Thomas Merton. Have you ever wondered what it means to search for true meaning in a life full of distractions, doubts, and worldly desires? Thomas Merton's The Seven Story Mountain invites us into that search. It's a spiritual autobiography tracing his journey from a restless youth to a Trappist monk devoted to God. A story of awakening, vocation, and the pursuit of a life aligned with purpose. Merton writes with honesty and vulnerability, sharing his struggles, doubts, and the transformative experiences that guided him towards monastic life. Through his narrative, we witness both his inner life, his contemplations, fears, and spiritual insights, and his external journey, through the challenges and decisions that led him to surrender to a higher calling. The book gives us a window into the profound tension between worldly desires and the call to spiritual life, and the sacrifices and rewards that come with answering that call. At its heart, the book explores themes of spiritual awakening, vocation, and personal transformation. Merton illustrates that true growth often requires letting go of familiar comforts and embracing uncertainty. He shows us that surrendering to a higher purpose is not a loss of self, but a path to fulfillment, clarity, and connection with the divine. Each chapter becomes the reflection on how life can be reshaped when one commits to values, discipline, and faith. Philosophically, Merton emphasizes that true fulfillment comes from living in alignment with spiritual principles, cultivating reflection, and committing to devotion. He invites readers to consider their own paths, to examine the ways in which vocation and faith can guide choices, and to explore what it means to live intentionally. So why would you read Seven Story Mountain? Because it offers insight into the spiritual journey, showing both challenges and rewards of following one's calling, and resonates with anyone seeking purpose, direction of understanding of how to align life with values and faith. After the break, let's read a part from this book.
IRIB English Radio.
Prisoner's Base on the last day of January 1915. Under the sign of the Waterbearer, in a year of great war, and down in the shadow of some French mountains on the borders of Spain, I came into the world. Free by nature in the image of God, I was nevertheless the prisoner of my own violence and my own selfishness. In the image of the world into which I was born, that world was a picture of hell, full of men like myself, loving God and yet hating him, born to love him, living instead in fear and hopeless self-contradictory hungers. Not many hundreds of miles away from the house where I was born, they were picking up the men who rotted in the rainy ditches among the dead horses and the ruined 75s in a forest of trees without branches, along the River Marne. My father and mother were captives in that world, knowing they did not belong with it or in it, and yet unable to get away from it. They were in the world and not of it. Not because they were saints, but in a different way, because they were artists. The integrity of an artist lifts a man above the level of the world without delivering him from it.
Thank you.
It did not take very much reflection on the year I had spent at Cambridge to show me that all my dreams of fantastic pleasures and delights were crazy and absurd, and that everything I had reached out for had turned to ashes in my hands, and that I myself, into the bargain, had turned out to be an extremely unpleasant sort of person. Vain, self-centered, dissolute, weak, irresolute, undisciplined, sensual, obscene, and proud. I was a mess. Even the sight of my own face in a mirror was enough to disgust me. When I came to ask myself the reasons for all this, the ground was well prepared. My mind was already facing what seemed to be an open door out of my spiritual jail. It was some 4 years since I had first read the Communist Manifesto, and I had never entirely forgotten about it. One of those Christmas vacations at Strasbourg, I had read some books about Soviet Russia, how all the factories were working overtime, and all the ex-mujiks wore great big smiles on their faces, welcoming Russian aviators on their return from polar flights, bearing the boughs of trees in their hands. Then I often went to Russian movies, which were pretty good from the technical point of view, although probably not so good as I thought they were, in my great anxiety to approve of them. Finally, I had in my mind the myth that Soviet Russia was the friend of all the arts and the only place where true art could find a refuge in a world of bourgeois ugliness. Wherever I got that idea is hard to find out, and how I managed to cling to it for so long is harder still, when you consider all the photographs there were for everyone to see, showing the Red Square with gigantic pictures of Stalin hanging on the walls of the world's ugliest buildings, not to mention the views of the projected monster monument to Lenin, like the huge mountain of soap sculpture and the little father of communism standing on top of it and sticking out one of his hands. Then, when I went to New York in the summer, I found the new masses lying around the studios of my friends. And as a matter of fact, a lot of the people I met were either party members or close to being so. So now, when the time came for me to take the spiritual stock of myself, it was natural that I should do so by projecting my whole spiritual condition into the sphere of economic history and the class struggle. In other words, the conclusion I came to was that it was not so much I myself was to blame for my unhappiness, but the society in which I lived. I considered the person that I now was the person that I had been at Cambridge and that I had made of myself. And I saw clearly enough that I was a product of my times, my society, and my class. I was something that had been spawned by the selfishness and irresponsibility of the materialistic century in which I lived. ¶¶ The months passed quickly, but not quickly enough for me. Already, it was June 1940. The 2 months that remained until the date in August when the doors of the novitiate would open to receive 30 or 40 new postulants seemed infinitely far away. I did not stay long in New York when I came back from Cuba. I was there only a few days, in which I went to the monastery on the 31st Street and learned from Father Edmund that my application for admission had been accepted, and that some of the necessary papers had arrived. It was a very good thing that this was so, because the postulants entering a religious order need documents from every diocese where they have lived for a morally continuous year since their 14th year, as well as a birth certificate and a lot of other things as well. But this was precisely the time when the German armies were pouring into France. At the moment when I stepped off the boat in New York, they had made their first great break through the French lines, and it had at last become obvious that the impregnable defense of the Maginot Line was a myth. Indeed, it was only a matter of a very few days before the fierce armored divisions of the Nazis, following in the path, broke out before them by the Luftwaffe, pierced the demoralized French army, and embraced the betrayed nations in arms of steel. They had Paris within a fortnight, and then they were at the Loire, and finally the papers were full of blurred wire photos of the dumb isolated dining car in the park of Compiègne, where Hitler made the French eat the document on which the 1918 armistice had been written. So too, if my father and mother's marriage certificate from St. Anne's in Soho, London, had not come in that year, it might never have come at all. I don't know if the parish records of St. Anne survived the blitzkrieg that was about to be let loose over the heads of the huge dark city full of sins and miseries, in whose fogs I had once walked with such wise complacency. But everything seemed clear. A month would go by, and then another, and soon I would be walking with my suitcase up some drab, unimaginable street in Paterson, New Jersey. You've been listening to IRIB English Radio. This was The Bookshelf with Nasreen Sayed, and we've been reading from The Seven-Story Mountain by Thomas Merton. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you will join us again next time.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Travel to a historical city, the goal is not just to visit museums and beautiful monuments, but you want to mix with the locals and learn about their traditions and culture. In recent years, many historical houses in Iran have turned to accommodation places, which are called Bumgardi. These are neither hotels nor hostels. They are local traditional houses that provide the opportunity for their guests to meet with locals and live like locals, even for a short time. Nartiti is the first house we visited, a beautiful place in the small town of Taft, with several traditional elements. An Iranian Zoroastrian couple owns the house. traveling also means doing activities that we would not have done elsewhere. Each night, all the travelers who stay in this cozy place meet with the owners of the house, drink tea, and eat freshly picked pomegranate from the backyard. And so, they can experience a little different trip and realize that we all share the same fundamental values and same objectives. We're all part of the same planet, and this makes us stay connected.
Staying at these kinds of places adds to one's understanding of the world and understanding of people. It is something which gives you an understanding that all of us are the same. We're all people. We're much more similar than we are different. And when you start taking governments and other things out of the situation... It's just, we can enjoy being with each other and understanding each other and learning about each other.
Another differentiating element of this house is a wall full of memories of those who stayed a while in this place. A very interesting wall that takes you to a journey around the world.
Une nuit dans cette maison est particulièrement une expérience particulièrement enrichissante. Enrichissante puisque ça permet de partager ces expériences entre les différents voyageurs qui se croisent ici.
In Iran, when a guest or loved one leaves our house, we accompany him or her to the door and throw water to show we want him or her to return very soon. With this compassion, we left that beautiful place to discover other local guest houses. The second place is the House of Baran, which means rain in Farsi, a beautiful adobe house that truly represents the city of Yazd. A very simple house, but artistically decorated and perfectly designed with traditional Persian elements, that constantly reminds you of the peaceful spirit of Iranians. A beautiful house with very positive energy. There's a logic behind the location of every piece in decorating this guest house. Some of these elements are symbolic, and some others are still functional.
This house has lots of interesting features for me as a visitor. Abbas, the owner of this guest house, had to adjust the stairs and make them more comfortable for us, people of modern age, to be able to walk down. Because apparently, back in the old days, they were building these stairs very high. Underground room. There is about 15 to 20 degrees Celsius temperature difference comparing it to upstairs. So making it a perfect room to chill and maybe take a nap during the hot days of summer. Also during the cold days of winter, this is gonna be a very warm room and area of the building. Few steps down and this tiny little room even gets cooler. An ideal, perfect place to keep your fruits and vegetables during the hot days of summer. Natural cooling system. You know why? Because it's connected to the wind tower room.
There is always a time to say goodbye to even the most beautiful things in this world. What you take from that location or moment is usually what you see or experience towards the end. An unforgettable taste with a beautiful color and very exciting recipe create an experience that I will take with me from Baran Guest House. The exciting thing about all these traditional guest houses is the fact that they're all different in some ways. One is famous for its traditional elements, one is known for its design and decorations, and the other has some very moving stories about the people who lived there, the people who run it now, their families and their relatives. Local people of different regions of Iran, full of love and passion, the most hospitable hosts that I have ever seen in my life. Jahangard Guest House is one of the few places that you can have a unique experience of meeting local elders, hear their stories, and learn about their experiences.
One of the benefits of staying at local guest houses is to have a chance to have this first-hand experience of seeing local handicrafts being made. And I really enjoy interacting with these people, talking to them, and of course learning from them.
One thing is to hear or imagine how life was back in the old days, especially inside these gorgeous traditional guest houses. Another thing is to live the life of those people and those days. It might be some very simple acts, or even sometimes symbolic, but they definitely worth the try. It feels amazing. Shahryar Azimi for Iran.